And it wasn't easy when they come to the valley, and they had to get established and everything. And I was born not long after they come to the valley. And so I do feel like I was a little bit of a pioneer. Because we never had any of the things that people considers absolute necessities.
And why were you so poor?
Why were we so poor? Well, my young life was during the Great Depression.
Yeah. But they came here with nothing?
Well, they come here seeking employment at the lumber mills and the sugar business. Mm-hmm. They were virtually all, they come here for farming. They bought farms, small farms to live on.
Do you know what they'd heard about the valley that made them think this was a promising place to try to find employment?
Well, because of the new sugar business, because they come from Utah where sugar beets were grown.
They didn't hear about the downside of that sugar business, huh?
Well, it hadn't been proven to be such at that time. And there was things developed in that sugar business that was not foreseeable at that time.
I have a supplement to one of the LeGrand newspapers at that time, which gives great detail about the beginnings of that sugar beet factory. Lists of all the donors and the research that they had done about sugar beet processing companies.
Before they actually built the factory.
Right. So I know it wasn't a fly-by-night operation.
Oh, no.
It was very carefully thought out. And that surprises me, and I think a lot of other people, that the supply of sugar beets wouldn't have been thought through better.
Well, they didn't have irrigation water.
I know.
If that had happened today, they had these deep wells, they could have watered
them.
They're growing sugar
beets. I know. I talked to the manager of the factory over in Nissa that processes sugar beets, and he says the Grand Ronde Valley is one of the most important suppliers they have of sugar beets.
Yeah. But anyway. Well, then the lumbering business was a thriving business.
Oh, yes.
Even before the turn of the century. And the Stoddards, that were some of the main lumber people, I knew many of them personally, of their later family.
Who did you know best in that family?
Well, David I. Stoddard, and he was one of the sons of the original George Stoddard family.
Was he a manager then?
When the Stoddard family moved the mill from Perry, Upper Perry here, to Condosa, he sold out, and then he became a bank president here in the Grand, and I knew him personally, and I knew a few of his brothers.
What caused them to move the mill from Perry?
The timber was more accessible. They were right in the middle of the timber company up there in Condosa.
You mean more accessible? They could get it out of the forest more easily?
Probably.
Whereas up at Perry, they had to bring it down by terrain or by slide it down the hills, didn't they?
Yeah, and they didn't have the big trucks then at all. And it all had to be done by railroad or floated. They floated a lot of the logs clear up from the Grand Ronde River up Tony Bay Meadows.
So was it simply then a matter of it's becoming too costly to operate a mill there?
Probably.
They had a huge investment, though, in it, didn't they?
Oh, yeah, but of course, if they moved the mill, their equipment, that's where much of your cost come.
Yeah. If they didn't have trucks, did they take it by train to Pondosa?
I didn't think
there was a train to Pondosa.
I remember when they moved. because when they quit up here, I remember that. But I don't remember. I wasn't worried about those things back when.
Do you remember seeing any of the operation of moving?
No. But I do remember my dad going up there when they sell him the last lumber to cash in what they had. He bought pine boards for $5 a thousand, and he built a garage from it.
So your father was a builder?
No, he worked for me in the later years of his life when he was older.
Tell me how you got involved in learning the skills of building.
Well, I never really got started till I was about 6 or 7 building things.
That's pretty late.
but I built things all my life.
It was just a knack that you had?
It was just a gift that came down through many generations.
Can you remember some of the first items you built?
Yeah. That was an interesting thing because we had, and I don't know who invented the idea, whether I invented them or who, but for us kids, as poor kids, we had bottle horses. You know what a bottle horse?
No, tell me.
Well, we used beer bottles, and the beer bottles back in those days had a narrow neck and a large body. And we made harnesses out of string, heavy sack string, and made harnesses that went down to single trees and double trees. You know what they are? That's the thing that horses, the way they use horses.
You know what? Tell me, because I'm not familiar with this.
And I made this set of bottle horses because my grandchildren, and telling them about it, they told their school teachers, and they wanted to see and to learn about that. And for years and years after I made these bottle horses and their harnesses and everything, I would take them to school up here in the great schools and show the classes how the toys that we had to play with as early.
Do you have one around here still?
I do.
Okay. Can we take a picture of it later then?
Sure.
Good.
But I started even way back then building things.
And you weren't working from any sort of pattern or model, I suppose.
No,
just out of your own head.
Make it up as we went along. And another thing, speaking of building, I designed a swing for small children. And I built one, built the very first one I ever had for when I was about 8 or 10 years old. And I
not the kind of swing you hang from a branch of a tree.
No, to this day we still make them for our grandchildren and great grandchildren. And but I did get started after you asked that question. I was real young when I made the first one. And so my building just come naturally and all. During my high school, I took shop and I built things back in those days. I built trailers, 2-wheel trailers and 4-wheel trailers.
Now, I imagine that the tools you were using then would have consisted of a hammer, a handsaw, probably some pliers, maybe wire cutters, a plane.
Plane.
What else?
Draw knife.
It's a draw knife.
It's a blade that has 2 handles.
Oh yes.
And they peel.
Sure.
Peel them
sure.
Off.
I've seen those.
And my brother and I, he was older, though about 9 years than I was, but we even went to the mountains east of Imbler out there and got 3 big wagon loads of holes that we cut, and we made a log cabin when I was a teenager.
Good project.
And that was so much fun. And it's still there today.
Used how now?
Out of the Nimbler.
How is it used now?
Oh, they... I'm not sure how they...
Is it a one-room cabin?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And they covered the logs since. Mm. Because logs are so difficult to maintain. Yeah. Log buildings. People that build homes out of logs, they have no idea what they're in.
Was that part of your shop class?
No, we did that on our own, but we built a whole full-size shop that my brother was very gifted in carpentry, became a cabinet maker. But we built it for a shop. We built our own wood lathe, and he bought some simple little tools, power saw, planer, and those things. And that's when I really got started. That both of my life's occupations was my hobbies, metalworking and woodworking. And they both become, I went to college to learn metalwork before the war started, World War II.
Which started. College?
Weaver College in Ogden, Utah. And then all during the war, I used my metal business because I worked for the Army Air Force during the war, doing metal work. It was a machinist tool dynamic. And then after the war was over, there wasn't any need for that, and I moved back to La Grande. And that's when I took up building.
I suppose it had been in your mind since you were a young boy that you probably would be a builder the rest of your life.
Well, I didn't. Really, I can't say that because metalwork was my first love. And to show how I left, and it's so contrary to my nature and disposition of being secure, but I left a permanent appointment with civil service down in Utah at the air base because after the war was over there wasn't anything to do at work, and I just wasted time for over 6 months. Never really did hardly anything constructive all those months, and I says I cannot spend the rest of my life with wasting time and doing nothing. And so I quit a permanent appointment and give up that to move back to La Grande and start here.
What do you think at that time was the attraction of coming back to La Grande?
Well, during the war, for security, our church had taught us all through our lives to be secure, to have a home, to have property, where you can raise gardens and all those things. Excuse me. And my wife and I bought an acre and a quarter of land next to my brother's place here in La Grande. And so we had been paying for that and had it near paid for when the war was over. And we just decided, well, it was home to me to come back. And that was the best reason. It just seemed like that it was meant to be.
Yeah. I know that feeling.
And so we think that there's a lot of promptings to do that, but anyway, it has certainly been worthwhile.
Now, when you started out, when you came back to La Grande in the building business, were you freelancing or working for somebody else?
The first thing I did was to start a home of our own. That's the very first thing I did for several months.
Using a plan that you'd gotten from somewhere? Your head.
We did.
Your head.
But, and then when ran out of money and had to go back to work, then I started to do carpenter work.
Now, is that house that you built still? Does it look the same?
Yeah, they haven't changed it much. Mm-hmm.
Where is it?
It's on 2008 H Avenue.
I can't think where that is.
All right. You go up 12th Street. You're going up 12th Street. Yeah. When you come to H Avenue, just turn left and go a couple blocks.
Not far from where John and Patty Turner live.
Now, let's see.
They live on G.
On G.
Corner of G and 5th.
Okay. Well, all in all, now this is clear across through the cemetery and everything.
Oh, I see.
But to get there, 12th Street is the main thoroughfare by the Armory.
Mm-hmm.
This house is not very far. On the way up to the Armory, you just turn left a couple blocks before you get there.
Okay. I might take a picture of that and include it in with your oral history.
But basically, they haven't changed the design. Okay. Some of the buildings, outbuildings, haven't changed. But that's, and then people decided to have them build houses, and I built way over 100 homes.
Well, you said after you'd built your house, or when it was mostly built, you were running out of money. So did you work for some other contractor then?
No. After that, people started to ask me to do building for them, smaller jobs, and then a little bit later, a man asked me to build his home. But then I did work for Miller's Cabinet Shop for about a year. And my brother worked there. And I learned many, many things when I was working at the cabinet shop. To build windows and doors and door frames and window frames and screen doors and to build kitchen cabinets and those things. And I did learn that. And that was a real blessing to me.
So did Miller's have a shop at that time
when
they built these things?
They did. A good, nice, big shop.
I should think you would have picked up many valuable skills during that time.
And that was in the valuable year of my life.
Uh-huh. Now, would that have been in the
1950s? Yeah, it was in about
40s.
About late 40s.
And at that time, of course, there were lots of plans available for houses, and of course, and I believe there was at least one architect living here in La Grande, wasn't there?
I'm sure there must have been, but I did much of the planning for a lot of the homes.
Well, that's what I was wondering. You would talk with the owner, the prospective resident there, and find out what they needed or thought they wanted.
That's right.
Then you'd come up with the plan.
That's right. I didn't draw very official plans, but if I knew the size of the house, their floor plan, and the type of roof and windows they wanted, and then I could go from there many times. And a lot of them would get magazine plans. Would come up with a lot of them were out of magazines. They weren't full-fledged plans.
Yeah.
Some of them would send away and get a set of blueprints.
Now, what kind of a financial arrangement did you usually make with those people?
Virtually, not all, but virtually most of the houses that I built, I did with time and material.
You had a standard rate on time?
So much an hour.
And would you typically have a couple of helpers?
After I started to build, I had from 3 to 4 or 5 people helping throughout the 30 years.
But you were doing a lot of the work yourself.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I worked every hour of the day.
Yeah. Did you have subcontractors?
Oh yeah, electrical. We weren't permitted to do on our own homes. We could, when I built this home, I did more wiring and plumbing, but you can't do that. Yeah.
And you were using subcontractors from within the valley?
Yes.
Who were some of them?
Oh, there was different electrical companies. Buckley, Lou Buckley was an electrician, and Allen Electric later on. Oh, goodness. Wow, I've almost forgot who they were. But Swivels did our plumbing, most of it. But and he, not Turner Heating, it was Parker Sheet Metal who put in a lot of our furnaces and things like that.
Did you develop some kind of a predictable time limit for building a certain kind of house?
When we started the house, we stayed on it until we finished it. We didn't job hop.
I never, one at a time, huh?
Well, we sometimes had two going.
Oh, you did.
But what I mean is that we didn't, we'd start a job and then go over and work on another for a week and then come back. We never did that. I never liked that. And if we couldn't put a time on a job and tell people that we would be there, why, we'd tell them if they want to wait, fine, but we're not going to promise you and then not be there.
Well, let's say an average size house, maybe three bedrooms, living room, dining room, kitchen, basement, what else?
And a garage.
Garage, okay. Well, what would be a typical amount of time that would it take to build that?
Probably 4 months.
4 months. Good. I call that speedy.
Well, because we stayed on it.
Yeah.
And we took it right from the footings to the finished product, till it was ready to move into.
Is your typical work season from about March or April through October?
We worked the year round.
How did you do that with
good
snow?
Good management.
Well, explain that.
Well, we'll take... this house, I built this house and one right up on the hill at the same time. But we managed and tried very hard to get a structure up to the square and get the roof on it
before
winter set in. And then when you got the windows in it, the doors, well, you could go in and you could build a fire and work inside the rest of the winter building, doing all the finishing of the cabinetry.
Did you bring in a temporary stove?
Yeah. Yeah, we had.
Still kind of uncomfortable, wasn't it?
Well, we had a wood stove that we could warm it with. And we would, sometimes we had fireplaces. We'd build the fireplace first and then and then we could burn the trash and stuff in the fireplace, and that would take the chill off. You didn't need it to 72 when you were working.
No, probably not. But were you typically building two at a time?
Not always. If they were bigger homes, work on them.
I was just trying to visualize whether you could keep a crew busy throughout the winter if you were only building one or two houses.
The thing of that is that I am our man that rarely ever missed a day's work in all those years. I just had a lot of sometimes smaller inside remodel jobs and things like that. And we were very blessed. And I feel that we had a good reputation because we always had jobs waiting.
What did you call your company?
Perry Builders.
Perry Builders, uh-huh. And when did you officially start that company? In the 40s?
Late 40s. Mm-hmm.
And is its present form Anderson Perry Engineering?
Oh, they weren't even heard of then.
Perry Builders doesn't exist now, does it?
Oh, no.
So when did you stop?
I stopped the building houses in 1975.
I see.
And some of the guys that worked for me wanted to continue the Perry Builder name, and I said no, because I had certain standards that I had, ethical things, and I wasn't sure that would be carried on.
As you think about the houses that you built, let's set aside for the moment commercial buildings. I know you did commercial buildings too, mm-hmm. but as you think about the houses you built in Le Grand, and I suppose you occasionally built in other parts of the valley,
and some out at Imbler, okay. Union, Willow.
Are there maybe two or three that you are most pleased with still?
Yeah.
You know where they are?
You bet. One of them in particular was the biggest home that I built, and I don't know the address, and I don't know the people who own it now. I know who I built it for. It was for two old bachelor farmers, Beezing brothers, mm-hmm. and they were prominent farmers out here on the coal road, going to coal. But their home is up on Sunset. Now let's see. I had a phone book. I could get the near address. The Dennis.
Mm-hmm.
I built it for Fred Kittle.
Uh-huh.
He used to own the Grand Round Grain Company and the flour mills here in the valley.
Mm-hmm.
And I designed these big homes, myself. And that was one of the fun parts.
Did you ever build one that would be called a Victorian style?
I'm not sure that I even know what a Victorian
style. Well, a lot of the houses in Union, some of the grander old houses there are Victorian style.
No.
They usually have a fairly large porch, and they often have a tower or a turret of some kind, and a fair amount of gingerbread on them. They don't look like this at all.
No. I never built one of them.
It sounds as though you were more influenced by recent ideas of building modern styles.
Yeah. You know, you can go around town and you can almost tell the time period the houses were built in.
I'll stop this for a minute.
Build.
I suppose the commercial buildings were jobs you had to bid for.
Generally. But there was a lot of them. They just hired us
because of your reputation.
We had established a reputation for being hard workers and honest, and it sure made our work a lot easier.
Uh-huh. Where was your office? Right here.
I get up early in the morning and I got a den in there.
Uh-huh.
That's where I did my bidding and payroll.
Didn't you need a place to store tools and materials?
I have two big shops out here.
I see.
And had you know, there's an interesting thing that a lot of people didn't do, but when we built homes, as soon as we got... Well, even before we got a roof on it, we'd take some of our power equipment, saws and things, and get it framed up and get a roof on. When we was ready to do the finish work, I had all my big tools that were on casters or wheels, and could just move all my tools right in we set up a shop right here, and we'd do all of our finish work, build all of our cabinets and everything. And we had everything right there close at hand.
Now, if you stayed in business till 1975, you of course changed a number of your building techniques, didn't you? With the availability of power tools and other kinds of shortcuts.
Yeah. Well, do you know that we built a lot of houses before we even had a skill saw?
You were doing it all with hand saws?
All with hand saws. Mm. Sawed all the rafters, the floor joists, the studs, and everything by hand.
Yeah.
And we drove... I never did own a nail gun. We drove all of our own nails.
Yeah. Would you claim that the use of power tools in any way detracts from the quality of workmanship?
I don't think so. No, it would enhance it, actually. And
it's hard to get a really straight cut with a handsaw, even if you're a good, experienced user of the saw.
You can't do it as well as a power saw.
Yes, that's right.
But it was very usable, very workable, but it slowed.
Yes.
So slow.
Yeah.
And we mixed, for many years, we mixed all of our own concrete with little hand mixers.
Mm-hmm.
And that is something different than having a big truck pull up and dumping it
all in
a few minutes.
Did you use rebar in the foundations?
Oh, some, but not to the extent that they do now.
Mm-hmm. Well, did you get most of your supplies locally?
Yes. That's one thing I really endeavored to do, was to buy locally. I rarely, only when people insisted, and then I let them go down maybe to Portland and buy their plumbing things and all.
Did you ever think that it was necessary to do advertising?
Excuse me. You know, that's an interesting question. I did very little advertising. I'll have to tell you one experience that I had. I remodeled the big sale yard out here on the way to Union. Did quite a lot of work for them. Of course, when they got through, they all over their arena, they had these great big signs advertising that people did.
Now, is this cattle sale?
Yeah, where they sell cattle every week. They'd have sales. People come from all over, hundreds of buyers. Well, naturally, after I did all that work for them, well, they wanted me to buy a sign, so I did, and it cost me $500-$600 to have that sign, that big sign in there and paint it. And interesting enough, I never got one telephone call as a result of that sign.
Mm-hmm.
Not one call.
That you know about.
Well, because I know the source of the other job.
I see.
And
nobody mentioned having seen the sign?
Never noticed. But the best advertisement that anybody, and this is true today, is satisfied customers.
Yep.
And that's what we endeavored to do. And when we finished a new big building or commercial building or something, why, you always have the things in the paper, you know, advertising the contractor and the subcontractors, just as a whatever you want to call it. But
they call it good PR now.
Yeah, but we did. I always bought a spot, you know, in the paper when we did that. But that's about the only building.
Now, you haven't today directly talked about inventing, but I know that you think of yourself as an inventor, and you've been inventing one thing or another for many, many years, I suppose.
Yeah. I would revert back just a bit on that other before we talk.
Okay.
I had a slogan that I used all through my business years. If you are not satisfied, tell us. And if you are, tell others. But I,
that's a good one.
But I used that all those years. Mm-hmm. And whenever I did advertise, why, I always put those. Mm-hmm. Okay, now back to the inventing.
Inventing, yes. This is something you've done all your life?
From the very start, when I was young, I always wanted to figure out an easier way to do things. When we lived out of Imbler, and we had cows and animals down at the barn, we had to carry every drop of water that they drank in buckets. We'd pump it with a hand pump and carry it clear down to the barn. But when I become a future farmer of America, I knew there's an easier way. And so I simply got a post hole digger and drilled a well and put a hand pump down there, pumped the water right into their watering trough. And that was just an example when I started out to wanting to do things easier.
Now, wanting to do things easier, that immediately raises questions. Why do you want to do a job easier? Some people would say, well, I want to avoid work whenever possible.
I think
others might say, I think it could be done more efficiently, and not just that it's easier, but it would be more efficient. You'd do better work if you had a different way of doing it.
Well, we never had any shortage of time particularly.
I didn't think so.
But the water business, that was to make it easier. That was terrible, a lot of work.
With drudgery?
Well, it was hard work. I don't know if you'd call it drudgery, but it was a lot of hard work.
Did some of it have to do with prioritizing your time? What was it most important for you to do to spend your energy, and was hauling water one of the less important things to do?
Well, I'm sure I could have found something more fun to do. Well, we didn't play basketball, but we young kids just don't like to be confined.
Tom Sawyer is the outstanding example of that, perhaps.
I'll give you another example of learning to do things easier. We had big gardens. We picked peas. We would go out early at daylight and pick maybe two big wash tubs full of peas, and then the whole bunch of us was set all day long potting peas to be bottled.
Yep.
And I did that for many years, and then I says there's got to be an easier way. So I would put my mind to work. We had an old wringer washing machine, and the roller to go through, and I devised a way of running those pea pods through that wringer wash machine, catching, having cloth, and catching them, and I could pod more peas than all the rest of the family put together.
Now, the trick there, I should think, would be apply just enough pressure so you don't squash the peas.
That's right. But it will roll them right out.
Mm-hmm.
And
did you have to feed the pod in just the right angle?
Well, we thought we did, but even at that, it was so much faster.
Yeah.
But
one at a time.
Well, you got to where you could be several. That's why you could do it faster.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And that was an example.
What did you have to invent there? Just changing the pressure
process. The process.
Well,
everybody had a washing machine.
The two ringers, the two rollers were already there, and there was the crank.
Well, I didn't invent the washing machine.
No.
But I invented the idea of doing it.
I'm trying to figure out, though, exactly what did you invent?
Outside of the process to do it, that was all invented on that.
Okay. Would it be true to say that you saw this wringer on the washing machine, and you saw the potting going on over here, and you put the two together?
Right.
Okay. That's good enough.
But...
And did it catch on? Did a lot of other people start doing that?
Not that I know of.
You didn't advertise.
No.
There you go.
I left home about a few years later. But
your own family didn't continue doing it?
Well, my wife and I did it when we moved back to La Grande in 46.
Yeah.
We did it then.
If you had a big pea harvest, I could see why you would.
You bet, because it takes a lot of time to pod peas.
Oh, yes.
That's
right.
But...
About as long as it takes to peel potatoes.
Yeah. But I... But when I was in high school, I built, like I said earlier, I built trailer for my family, and I built a four-wheel trailer to haul hay on. And then when I moved from Utah here, I bought an old car and took the body off of it and the engine, and I made a big four-wheel trailer and moved all of our household.
Yeah, were these inventions?
Well, to the way I made the, took an old car and made, put a tongue and steering deal and everything on it. I designed all of it.
So you adapted a machine that had been designed for some other purpose to...
No, I made the tongue and the guiding part of it. I designed that.
Yeah, but wasn't that adapting something that had been built before?
Well, the wheels and the frame,
yeah.
That didn't work.
The example you gave in the interview with Vanessa was the communion glass filler machine.
Well, now that...
That sounds rather complicated.
That I developed from scratch.
Mm-hmm.
There
was an example of seeing what you thought was a need that had to be done more quickly or more efficiently, and there was nothing other than pouring it by hand.
There was nothing that was as successful up to that time.
So that's clearly an invention.
That's right.
Starting with essentially nothing except a need.
Mm-hmm. I've invented different toys that I made, like that swing I was telling you about. I developed different toys that our children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren are using.
Have you patented any of these?
Not the toys, but
yeah, or anything.
Well, I did this water glass filler, and when the Brigham Young University learned about this water glass filler, why their food management, and they had big banquets down there, 5,000 at a time, you know. They asked me to develop a big water glass filler to fill their drinking glasses. And so I did that, and it would fill 36 water glasses at one time. Just they'd slide a tray under there and push a lever, and it filled all of them. Well, we got to have ice in them. So, they didn't say that. They wanted me to do one to fill their punch glasses, because they didn't serve coffee down there. They served punch at their banquets. And so that required a lot different sort of thing, because you had to have a reservoir to put the punch in. And so I made them one that they could fill 36 punch glasses at one time. And they used it for years and years down there at BYU.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, the last I saw, and that's been several years ago, they still have the punch machine, but the water glass had wore out. I'd repaired and done things for them. And so I don't know where it is now. But anyway, that was from scratch.
Mm-hmm.
Both of those units were from scratch.
And you're still inventing, I'll bet.
The what?
You are still inventing, I'll bet.
I design for whatever the need might be.
What's the most recent thing you've done?
I'd have to stop and think. But I could give you a whole list. Right now my mind has just gone blank.
Okay. If you think of something, please let me know.
I've invented game sleds that fold up in a suitcase size, and you can carry them hunting. And when you get ready to drag in an elk or a deer, you just open up the sled and tie the deer to it. I've invented winches I made a winch on a little tote goat. You ever know what a tote goat is?
No, tell me.
Yeah, well, it's just a little slow speed motorcycle that it haven't been made for many years. And you could climb a telephone pole with it when you ride it on home. But we used to haul deer in on it. But sometimes when we kill a big animal, an elk or deer down in the canyon, have you ever hunted?
No.
Well, you wouldn't know how much work it is to get a big animal. Mm-hmm. Well, I made this winch and put on this little tote goat. Tie the tote goat to a tree and run 1,000 feet down a canyon and grab hole or tie on to an elk and pull it right out of the canyon.
Using the power from the tote goat?
That's right.
I see.
And you could ride any place around in difficult places.
Now the sled, it would go over
Was designed to go between limbs and trees.
It didn't require snow to operate right. It didn't require snow operate on.
Oh no, it's either snow or dry land, whichever. Okay. Mm-hmm. But some examples of some of the things. Mm-hmm. I've built wood splitters designed to split wood, and I have one of those. And I made a big winch to drag logs. And I have that, and we've used it. So,
some of these things other people must have heard about and been interested in. So, did you make multiple copies of some of these things you invented for use by other people?
Very few. I just a one-time thing for my own use and satisfaction.
Is that because you're so modest?
So what?
Modest.
You know, now to go back to this water glass filler that I've made for Brigham Young University, I made a commercial filler, and I have it, a sample of this commercial filler that for restrooms, where now let's see, I can't even remember how many glasses it filled, but it was the same size rack as they use in their dishwasher. And you can just slide a rack of glasses in and fill them like that.
Yep.
I come this close to having a personal interview with, what was his first name, Marriott, that has all the hotels and the food services and things that they have, because I wanted to see if I could get this in their hotels, in their restaurant, part of their dining, part of their business. But unfortunately, that interview fell through, and I can't even remember why. But I still have my prototype sitting down here in my basement.
If they had said yes, they wanted it, would you have built several versions of it?
I'd made a decision, rather than to pursue the commercial end of it for restrooms, to divert my time to building the sacrament filler for the church.
So you built all those copies?
Well, I had expensive big molds made to make all the components.
I see.
And I assembled them right here.
Metal involved in this?
there was a few metal parts, mm-hmm. but most of it was plastic.
I see.
And they had to be done by injection molding. Yeah. And I still have those expensive molds, but I haven't made any for several years.
The demand is still there, isn't it?
Well, the need for it is, but for some reason or another, there was a few people that had a bad experience or something. They didn't clean them properly, and it caused a bit of concern with some of the leaders.
Sanitation, you mean?
Sanitation line. And so I made 3,000, and so they had gone all over the United States and Canada.
Did you sell them at cost?
Oh, I made a little profit, but it took years and years to regain investment of those moles, because they were awful expensive. But, let's see, what else have I... I just, whenever there's a need for something, I just build it. The latest thing I've done was a gadget to dig gophers up at our family camp, ground.
You mean
dig out their hole.
And
I just made that this week.
Kill them or just extract them?
No, you see they make mounds.
Yes.
You clean the dirt off and you and with this pointed instrument with a handle on it, I can find their hole, clean the hole out, put poison grain in, and then cover it back up.
You're not fond of gophers?
Pardon?
You're not fond of gophers?
Well, they just destroy your lawn. Mm-hmm. Out in the middle, beautiful green lawn, and mm-hmm. great big hills mm-hmm. of dirt.
Of course, you might ask, who was there first?
Yeah. But that's the latest thing I've done just this week.
I see. you've mentioned the church several times, and you spoke to Vanessa about misconceptions of LDS members. I'd like to follow up that a little bit. I know something about the history of the church. My grandfather was a doctor in Palmyra, not far from where the angel Moroni was uh-huh. supposed to have talked to Joseph Smith. And I've been out there more recently, and I've seen his house and uh-huh. and the place where they do the reenactment there. Mm-hmm. And I've talked to a number of people who belong to the church, mm-hmm. but I've never asked anybody before. I've read about the Nauvoo episode and mm-hmm. so on. I've never asked anybody why these misconceptions arose. What is there about the faith or the behavior of members of the church that caused these misconceptions to arise?
You know, I'll start with one, that the Mormons have horns.
Yeah, you referred to that, looking in little kids' hair to see whether they could find them, Now this is outrageous.
I can't even imagine.
Some connection with the devil?
Maybe. Well, now maybe that could be.
Devils are supposed to have horns.
Yeah, because there was so much hate. The thing that I think that caused a lot of that early hate, because the church members were united in what they did in building homes mm-hmm. and in standards of living, mm-hmm. that when an election come up, if it was in the area where there was a majority of the members of the church, why, they could vote one way and enact the law.
Now, it sounds to me that the basis for that among the people who disliked or said they disliked LDS members would have been a combination of fear and resentment.
Yeah, I think so. And and then from the very inception of when the church began to be restored people's ignorance of God, of what God is, and His Son Jesus Christ, is so different in the world than the concept that the LDS people have of it. Because, see, Joseph Smith, a 14-year-old boy, had this vision, and as an answer to prayer, then he saw our Father in heaven, and he saw the Son Jesus Christ when he went out into the world with this new concept that they were glorified personages, heavenly place personages. Why, it was rejected from the very, very moment it was mentioned by minister particularly, because they weren't, it was against their teaching. But as far as the horns, maybe it did, that they considered them kind of devils. And because they did have extreme hate for their people. And I don't think they even knew why.
It's my understanding that most members of the church have been noted for their being industrious.
Right.
And being careful about their health and about their living conditions. And I suppose people who do that, especially if there are several of them doing it together, could arouse suspicion on the part of the others. Who do they think they are? Do they think they're superior?
Better.
Superior, yeah. Of course, jealousy then becomes part of the reaction.
Yeah. And you know what's interesting about that? Very thought, there's been surveys made not by our members of our church, but people who live these standards, live, oh, what is it, 6 or 7 years longer than other people.
I've also heard that until recently, perhaps, many LDS members have seemed to other people to want to stay apart, to sort of be a tight little group by themselves and not to interact a lot with other people in the community.
Now, let's see, how shall I put this? We are a tight, united group. We have all of our organizations within itself where we keep, we work together for common purposes. That don't mean that we don't go out and make our living. Look how I made my living.
Yes.
I built for members, non-members alike. And look at Anderson and Perry, what they do. They don't just do work for members. And some of our leaders in our whole community are LDS.
Mm-hmm.
So we do associate with all other people.
I think many people who might think this are referring primarily to social interactions, not
yeah.
occupations
yeah.
or not professionals.
Well, now, socially, we do things, a lot of things. Let me, there's one thing that I know gives people a misconception. Let's take Easter. It's a very prominent celebration time for all churches. All the churches put their big ads in the Saturday paper about Easter services. Well, we have big Easter programs and services too. But we don't advertise it in the paper that we have these. And a lot of people said, the Mormons don't even have an Easter service because it isn't in the paper. And it's misconception. But I'll be the first to say that we are organized within the church, and we do things unitedly together a lot. But our non-member friends are just as invited as anybody else.
When you were first here in the Valley, say in your first 20 years or so of life, did you had the sense that there were more people who had misconceptions about LDS members than now?
Well, They still do.
Well, I know some do, but what was it more prevalent then?
Well, I don't know how you'd really judge that.
Just your sense of it.
But I guess I've sensed it more lately because right in our community, there are people, and I could name them, some of them, at churches this very day are teaching their people misconceptions about our belief. And I could name you a half a dozen of them. And they have published literature against the church, and they're telling their people that we don't believe in Jesus Christ, that we worship Joseph Smith, and the list goes on. And it is